This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and I want to start at Queen's Park and a major development in a scandal swirling around the Ford government. Now, the OPP confirms, as you heard in Jeremy's news, that it is probing Keel Digital Solutions, a company that's received $40 million from the government, including $7.5 million from the Skills Development Funds flagged by the Auditor General. Now, so far, this whole thing has not touched the Premier, and he is resisting calls to fire David Piccini, the Labour Minister. But my question is it just a matter of time before that happens? And how is it that it doesn't seem to be hurting Doug Ford? I'm kind of wondering. And Mr. Carney went to Washington for the FIFA draw, where he looked chummy with both Trump and Mexican President Sheinbaum. Now, my contacts who know such things say the games we drew were, you know, ho-hum, except for the price tags for them, of course. And now Trump, who was smiling and talking about how friendly we are, is musing about punitive tariffs on Canadian fertilizer on top of everything else. And there's been no movement on the Liberals' hate crime bill, and not a word from those Liberals in Ottawa and the others on the latest round of anti-Semitic hate crimes. Police are investigating the theft of mezuzahs, religious scrolls, from a seniors building run by the city, where people who live there include Holocaust survivors. It must be terribly traumatic for them.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome in studio. It's like a party in here. It's, you know, it's December. It's party time. We'll have to take a great picture after the panel, but I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, former Ontario Deputy Premier and Health Minister, journalist and lawyer Tasha Carradine, and former city councillor and consultant Rob Davis. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry I forgot my mistletoe, though.
Okay. Well, wait a minute.
Don't get cheeky there.
Look, there's a Christmas tree with a Santa's hat.
There you go.
On
That's
top
close.
Of it.
That's
very
close.
Festive.
Yeah. I haven't brought in the menorah yet.
It's mistletoe adjacent. That's pretty good.
Oh, I like that. I like that. But I don't know if Santa is bringing good things for the Ford government. How long can they resist this?
You know, Libby, I don't know if Piccini is going to be there after the holidays. I really do wonder. The house is going to rise, so that decision won't be made immediately. But I think that all the troubles that have been happening, not only with this file, but with everything else in terms of the awarding of contracts, really makes it hard for the government to justify that he's still there. I think, you know, honestly, it's a testament, I think, to the weakness of the opposition. You know, the Liberals don't have a permanent leader, and Merritt Stiles manages to get herself kicked out of the legislature and other sort of shenanigans. But otherwise, I think he would have been gone before this situation. But with a criminal investigation, it makes it very hard, I think, for them to keep him on.
And Rob, one of the theories, though, that I hear is that the Premier is keeping him around because he can take the fall, because otherwise some of it might point back to the Premier.
Well, there's a political strategy there, in that you keep the minister who's responsible for what may have gone on in there long enough, so that when the axe does fall and all of the unknowns are known, that he can actually take the blame. But if you replace that minister, obviously, prematurely, then certainly the premier becomes the one in the hot seat because the minister responsible at the time is no longer in the chair answering the questions. So there is a strategy there. I feel that this is the gift that keeps giving, speaking of Christmas, to the opposition. If they could just get their hands around it and really exploit it, it seems to me that for whatever reason, you know, Merritt Stiles is doing an okay job. The Liberals seem to be nowhere on it. And I would think that anyone who wanted to be the new Liberal leader would be the one jumping on this, trying to demonstrate their ability at prosecuting the case against the government. That doesn't seem to happen. I'm not sure why leadership hopefuls aren't jumping on this.
Are you sure there are leadership hopefuls?
Well, maybe we're sitting on either side of one right now. I'm not sure.
George, over to you.
Oh, thank you for that opening, counselor. I would say that, I think to the point about opposition, I think if you really want to take a government minister down in kind of a scandal scenario, you have to be prepared to exhaust it to the point where everybody else in caucus that wants to ask a question about class size or wait times or physicians or what have you, you have to kind of push them aside. And most political parties don't actually have the discipline to do it. The Liberals especially should understand, like, Mike Cole went down as a minister for a very, very, very modest thing compared to what's up there with Piccini. Obviously, he enjoys a lot of confidence from the premier. The way that they put Joe Manchinelli out last week.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking.
Like that was a strenuous defense. That wasn't a sign of people that were throwing in the towel because Joe Manchinelli is a man that, you know, he moves opinion. He's a deeply respected person. At least I personally respect him a lot. So I saw that as noteworthy. I think that there's a danger for the Conservatives to keep saying but it's not hurting us in the polls. I think you just have to look to the Premier of Quebec to see that sometimes things add up and then before you know it, there is something of a pendulum swing. So I think that there's a thematic to this, which is that Ford's frequently taking care of his friends. And when he gets caught, like on the land thing, he apologizes. But this bears quite a bit of connection to Ford, right down to the dental practice that the other members of the Ford family used and are photographed at. So I think there's a lot of legs to this. And the last thing I'll say is the OPP investigation sounds troubling, of course. Who would want that hanging over them? But they almost never come back with anything or even seem to conclude investigations.
Do you agree with Tasha that Piccini won't be here in January?
I would say that that's the conventional wisdom, but I really think I don't know for sure. I really don't know for sure, but I do believe, and to my Manchinelli point, that Ford is not throwing, at least as of last week, was not throwing in the towel. But whether the OPP thing is a tipping point and they feel like they have to, that certainly could play itself out.
Well, with the question that I got, I mean, Manchinelli's union support Ford, and I wonder with this whole thing, I mean, could it go back to Joe Manchinelli and deals about who was getting those skills development money?
This is the question, is how many people in Ford's orbit are actually tarred with this thing? And now the OPP is taking it away. That, in a sense, it buys time. To your point, George, there will be a report tomorrow, but it's also not a good look. One way for Ford to get out of this is do a general cabinet shuffle in January and shuffle Piccini out. He could be removed from cabinet. He could be, just taken out, replaced by somebody else without singling him out as the only person who leaves. I think also that, you know, that we got to remember that the Greenbelt investigation is still going on. The RCMP is investigating the premier and other members on the Greenbelt. And we kind of forget about this.
Yeah, so, no kidding. We do.
So this is not, again, it's this tipping point business that was mentioned. Like in Quebec is a different animal because there's an exhaustion there, not with potential corruption, but just general fatigue in politics. But if you add the smell of corruption to fatigue, which in Doug's Ford's been in there for how many terms now? Two. People can get tired. And if you have a good opposition leader, like a strong Liberal leader, which we're still, you know, waiting for one, then you could have momentum against the government.
Well, I remember a time when I thought, okay, Ford's done around the land scandal,
right,
and it all passed. And you're right, we don't remember. And, you know, frankly, Merritt Stiles, from a year ago or whatever, I found her more on point. Now it's just like scream, 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 scream. You know, I hope that's not sexist.
I was going to say, you know, that's almost that sounded a little misogynist. I'll say this. No, but women have a greater difficulty in communicating because of the perception that they're screaming when they're, you know, raising their voice. You know, it's about
my husband tells me I'm screaming a lot when I'm not screaming.
There's a way to do it that isn't seen as hectoring, and it's seen as constructive. And I think the problem is she's not seen as constructive.
Right.
And
I think getting kicked out around the word corruption was wise. I really actually think it plays into the idea that she's got to double down on it. I thought that was actually... It's very rarely that something happens these days in question period that becomes newsworthy, and she made it newsworthy, and she put a big circle around the word that you're not allowed to say in that place. I thought that was actually pretty wise, but to my earlier point is like, if you really want to take someone down, you have to double and triple down on it. You can't spread all of your ammo across all of the variety of issues that are there. To your fatigue point, I personally think there is a budding healthcare fatigue problem for the Ford government that has mostly been masked with all of the focus on Trump and tariffs. But I do think there's a building fatigue in many places that they have around healthcare challenges.
There's also going to be a fatigue around jobless numbers if they get worse. They've gotten better lately, but yeah,
temporarily.
There's a huge... Exactly. Yeah. Potential with all the issues that are coming down with tariffs, with the auto sector, things could get worse dramatically in the next year.
I want to move up the road, but before, since you brought up the leaderless leadership, what's happening there? Is there anybody being touted? Is there anybody who looks interested? I mean,
what's the irony, isn't it, of kicking out the leader or not? You know. Suggesting that she should be gone, and then having nobody seemingly coming in to fill the void. It's sort of like,
I thought only conservatives do that.
We don't know who we want, but we certainly don't want her. And I think it was honestly, I thought the Liberals should have given her a second go round. I think it's something that all political parties should do. You know, Mike Harris lost his first election, then came on back to win two back-to-back majorities. I think you got to give people a chance to be known by the electorate, to sort of fill the shoes of being the leader, to understand how this, you know, weird arcane mechanism of party politics and provincial politics works, to allow them the opportunity to win. So I think the Liberals made a mistake in kicking out Bonnie Crombie, but it's interesting because there doesn't seem to be anyone filling the vacuum.
I think the issue was losing her seat. I think another second chance. Look, Pierre Poilievre got a second chance after losing his seat. Maybe there's a bit of misogyny there to go to that point, that she didn't get that same sort of recognition.
Well, they didn't have enough seats for her to give up.
Well, there's that too. At the same time, though, it was, they haven't found who, you know, who is the point? Who is there? And there's nobody running around going, pick me.
Yeah.
I don't believe. I think
you're a liberal, so.
Yeah, that's true. I wrote after the election that Bonnie should get a chance to stay on because the one and done culture is not a good one. I think the problem wasn't just that she lost her seat, but there was quite a bit of incompetence in the organization taking stock of Ford's threat to have an early election that some people in her campaign group didn't actually seem to absorb as a strong likelihood. I think that undermined her. But everybody else on the outside's got the same problem. How do you get into the legislature? And it doesn't seem like anybody in the current caucus is exactly getting people very excited. So it is a dilemma point. There are some new names out and about.
I'll give them before we move on.
Well, you know, one example would be Mike Crawley. Mike Crawley was once the president.
A reporter.
Mike Crawley was once the president of the Liberal Party of Canada and was very involved in green energy businesses, been quite successful, quite a good speaker, etc. I haven't spoken with him, but that's definitely a name that I heard. Dr. Andrew Buzari from UHN certainly was being encouraged to take a look at it. I saw him a week or two ago. That doesn't seem as hot a prospect, but
he'd be like a very left-wing Liberal leader.
The thing is that what I try to tell anyone is, like, don't go and run for the Liberal Party in its current iteration. Tell me what you're going to do to make it different, to build on what's there. I know what's there pretty well, and it's not enough to win. But it's a tough task, unless you're personally wealthy or what have you. Like, not that many people actually have the capability to throw themselves into a job like that without much of a resource basis is a very narrow, it's a very narrow offering.
Okay, let's move up the 401 Ottawa. Carney went to Washington last week. They got a nice photo op with Trump and Sheinbaum. But what did he come away with? I would say bupkis.
Yeah, basically. I mean, now we're having threats of tariffs on fertilizer from Donald Trump. And Donald Trump said when they asked him, are you going to renegotiate Kuzma? He said, we'll see. We'll see. Those are the words. So they apparently had a nice little chat. It was friendly, but the issues remain, Libby. And the fundamental issue of Kuzma is huge because it exempts 85% of our products from tariffs. If we don't have that deal, everything's on the table.
Is it like bait and switch? Because Trump says, we'll see. And then Hoekstra, the ambassador here, the American ambassador who is not overly friendly to us Canadians, says, oh, no, I don't think there's any intention to not renegotiate Kuzma or Asmica or whatever you want to call it. I mean, is it just like confuse us, turn our heads so much that we'll sign whatever they put in front of us?
I think Trump is like a cat playing with its food. And unfortunately, we're the food, right? It's like, I might kill you, but I might let you live, and I might kill you, but I might let you, like, it's, we're that mouse.
Swatting us around.
And it can change day to day. And I don't think his advisors frequently know either. Yeah, I think they're actually as stuck off the base, or however you say that, as we frequently are.
Yeah, I think he catches them off base, and he catches them by surprise, because it depends on what he's thinking at the time. And I think the whole notion of creating chaos and negotiations is who he is. You know, I haven't read Art of the Deal, but my understanding is that's a big part of what he does in private
people,
in the private
keep people
sector.
Off balance. He also has other priorities right now. I mean, Ukraine and the Middle East are his two priorities in terms of settling conflicts.
Ukraine,
and
he's
ahead.
Like.
Yeah,
no.
Well, but the point is it's ongoing. And that's sort of in the back of his mind, I think. There's certain things he sort of comes back to us because FIFA, because we were there. But otherwise, would he have said anything? Would it have been even a comment about Canada? Probably not.
This thing with the farmers. So the American farmers are suffering because of those tariffs. So he gets them all in a room and says, I'm giving you a $12 billion aid package. Oh, and the only reason I can give this to you is from tariffs. As if they're too dumb to know that the reason they need a bailout package
is because of tariffs.
And not to mention that he bailed out, or Bessant did, Argentina, mm-hmm. who are the ones that are actually getting the work to sell the same products to China, et cetera. It's a very weird one when you look at it. Then you can see the way his cost mind is working. What are the input costs farmers face? Oh, fertilizer is up. And then that draws into kind of his onshoring instinct, which exists, frankly, across numerous sectors.
But fertilizer, I mean, they need us. They don't have the stuff, right? Right.
They don't have aluminium. They don't have that.
Very British.
I know.
But to your point, and I remember this back in January of this year, where he said, we don't need their lumber. We don't need their... Like, I have a video of some politicians saying, you know, we listen and we don't judge, looking at a video of Donald Trump saying, we don't need anything that Canada makes, quite frankly. And in fact, they need a heck of a lot of what we make.
They need our potash.
They need everything. They need our potash. They need our oil. They need our lumber. They need our brains. They need all of the things that we manufacture to them, in part because we have a low dollar, that are advantageous to their manufacturers. And I just think, in terms of input costs, I just think he's not only playing with us, but he's also playing with the American people, in terms of those who may not be aware of how integrated our economies are.
What's that old saying, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public?
Or
Americans, some of my smartest friends are Americans, but...
Yeah, it is unfortunate. I mean, he regularly engages in these kinds of, you know, wrong statements. I mean, there's no fact. You can't fact check this anymore because we've fact checked it to death. We know it's wrong. Things he says about the costs of our dairy, for example, things he says about not needing. And softwood lumber is a particular example. The quality of lumber in Canada is why they buy us our stuff. We have product that they need for construction. They don't grow it in the States like we do. So there's things we produce they actually do not have. But he'll say that because it plays to his electoral base and because his view, like you said, George, is he's a fundamentally 19th century mercantilist view of the economy based on tariffs, not taxes. And the tariffs you can give back to people, bribe them with their own money, like he wants to do with the farmers.
Well, you can do that with taxes too, can't you?
You can, but it's a particular way where he says, look, the rest of the world is, you know, we're making money from them when really it's people are paying these tariffs and he's just giving the money back to them.
Yeah, the American people are paying the tariffs, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And they know it. Like I think deep down they know it. But it's interesting. It's almost as if they like being lied to.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
If the polling in the United States, at least I saw some recently, is any reflection of reality, then it's not like he's making big breakthroughs with everybody. A lot of his biggest issues, he's like in the high 30s, showing a 25-point gap, even around things where he's invested so heavily, like immigration policy and stuff like that. So I do hold out hope also when I see is like sometimes we think, oh, well, like we think in the that all Americans are the same or there's this great big groundswell behind Trump, at least from some of the polling that I've seen recently, not so much. And it does give a little bit of hope around the midterms. Like, to what extent can we count on the midterm result bringing Congress, at least one branch of it, back into the mix?
Of course, he says that they don't do well in midterms because he's not on the ballot. I mean, it's unbelievable. But let's, Tasha, you wrote a column on the Liberals' hate crime bill, which I guess was an attempt to show us that they care. But I don't believe it.
Well, Bill C-9, yeah, it's actually going to committee today. And the big issue this week has been the deal with the Bloc Québécois to remove the religious exemption for hate crimes. And that the Bloc said that deal fell apart on yesterday. Now, apparently it's back on. That's what we understand. The deal's back on. And
the explain the deal.
So the deal is, well, the exemption would say that if you base your speech on a religious text, for example, an honest belief, you can be exempted from a hate crime. Okay, this leads to all sorts of places, and a number of Jewish organizations, including CEJA, have put out a statement yesterday saying that this is an excuse for anti-Semitism, in particular, in the last few years. And you cannot base, your statements don't have impunity just because they're based in faith. Quebec comes from a different perspective. They are very secular in their government. And so that's why they support this exemption. So the government apparently had made a deal with them because they need their votes. It's a minority, right? Liberals. Yeah. They need the Bloc's votes to pass the bill. So they agreed to remove this exemption. And then apparently they backtracked because there was some outcry in caucus. They claimed it was because the prime minister's office hadn't known about this deal, but apparently no. And that's because there are faith groups, including Muslim groups, that complained, and Catholic bishops too, and the conservatives who said, you know, we've got to have this religious protection. So the bills, this is one of the biggest issues in the bill. It's coming to committee today, and the understanding is the exemption will be removed. That is what I've heard, the scuttlebutt latest. We'll see if it happens by, I think, 3:30 this afternoon.
But yeah, I mean, in the meantime, it's quite ironic. We had this anti-Semitic incident on the weekend, and suddenly out of the blue there's a statement from Chow which reeks of hypocrisy in my opinion, but no one else. Don't hear from Doug Ford, don't hear from Mark Carney certainly, and you know, the police are investigating. I mean,
it's disturbing, you know, on a lot of fronts. And before the show started, you know, I reminded Tasha Kierden that, you know, and probably George did this, you know, whenever as a politician, we're in neighborhoods where there's a masseuse, you know, we take special care. We know, you know, not to knock on their doors on the Sabbath. I was one of those guys who put out Rosh Hashanah cards, and everyone thought, oh my God, a black Jewish guy is running. This is amazing. You know, like, and I said to one lady, I said, I can assure you, madam, I'm one of those things, and I'll let you guess. But you know, and I come from a household where we, you know, my family purchased their home from a Jewish family. And I could tell you 40 years later, that masseuse, or 50 years later, oh my God, I'm getting old, that masseuse still sits on the doorframe. It is extremely disturbing to me, for all of these reasons that I expressed, that somebody would use their knowledge as a way to inflict this kind of pain on a community.
Like, and these are older people.
They're older people. I've met, my neighbor was a Holocaust. This is disgusting.
Yeah.
This is one of the most distasteful things that you can do. And when you have the opportunity to visit places like Bergen-Belsen, as I have, or to go to the new synagogue in Berlin, as I have, to see what happened in the aftermath of Kristallnacht, then you understand that people's fears are legitimate. And they need to be taken seriously, and governments at all levels need to say something and do something about this.
I mean, yeah, my parents were Holocaust survivors, and, you know, sometimes it looks like we're in, like I say, is it 1938? Mm-hmm. Is it 1937? But it looks a lot like that, and in terms of the things that are tolerated.
Well, it's unfortunately, yeah, it's these things strike at the core because they were exactly the same tactics that were used in those times. And so naturally people think that's what's coming. The difference is now we are aware of what went before, and we should act against these hate crimes much more vociferously than we have. And that's where, again, this bill, you know, to excuse statements, like in Quebec, for example, statements by imams saying that, you know, Allah is calling for Jews to be killed, or prayers in front, Muslim prayers in the street. That was one of the tipping points in Quebec, Muslim prayers in the street in front of Catholic churches. It's a weaponization of faith, and it shouldn't happen for any faith, right? But right now, since October 7th, is particularly targeting the Jewish community.
And then the argument, George, is that stopping a Muslim prayer in the street, blocking off the street, is somehow discriminatory.
You know, I'm, as a gay person, I can't find affinity exactly with the circumstances of people that are survivors of the Holocaust, et cetera. But I do know what it's like to have hate wrapped in religion thrown my way. And as a gay person, that's mostly, frankly, from Christian, claiming Christian religions. I do find myself a little bit prone to the secularist nature of Quebec in these matters, in terms of removal of religious symbols from the daily governmental life, etc. I think it's very intriguing that they took the tact of saying that Fraser hadn't and his team hadn't consulted with the PMO on it, because if that really actually was, like, that's a really, really bad place to hang your hat, because it significantly also undermines somebody that's a power, you know, an important and thought to be one of the better performing members of the Prime Minister's cabinet. So I thought that was a little weird tactically when I read that in the press. Okay. I just want to say, like, on the volume of anti-Semitism, I mean, it's so distressing, but is it so voluminous? Is it actually practical that every time you see an anti-Semitic event, all of the politicians on road are going to uncork a quote or a comment? Like, that's the volume has become so extreme.
No, but the scale of this particular act, and the fact that it was a state run or a city run, building, I think, begs for comment from political leadership.
City officials, at least.
Well, the mayor who doesn't have a lot of street cred on this, let's say.
She did say something this
frontally.
Time.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, she's maybe she's around. Learning.
All right.
This is great conversation, but we're out of time. So I'm going to say goodbye to Tasha Carrot and George Smitherman and Rob Davis.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We are switching gears now. Very different topic. And as Canadians prepare for the holiday season, many will be spending longer in-person time with their parents and grandparents, and in some cases, for the only time during the year. Now, these moments are crucial in noticing changes that would not be as apparent over phone calls or quick check-ins, changes that could indicate the onset of dementia or any other decline. So to talk about that, we've got Dr. Howard Chertko, who is a practicing cognitive neurologist at Toronto's Baycrest Health Sciences Center. Hi, Dr. Chertko. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Libby. Nice to be back.
So tell us about this. You know, I hadn't thought of this, but I think it's a very interesting note because people will be getting together with the older generations of their families, perhaps that they haven't seen in quite a while.
Yes, we hear this a lot. I work at the memory clinic at Baycrest, and we hear a lot from families that they hadn't seen their a parent or a grandparent in months, and they get together for the holidays, and they're shocked by a change. So the first thing that I always say is we've got to cut people some slack over the holidays because people arrive, they've been traveling, they're tired, they're maybe in a different surroundings, maybe they're taking sleeping pills. So people are not at their best. There's no doubt about that. But the important thing is to look for change. Someone, for example, when I've had a situation of the kids visiting from Vancouver, they say, our mother couldn't put on the big meal. She puts on the big meal every holiday season, and now she couldn't do it. So change in performance, the mother just couldn't organize. This is called executive function, and this is one of the early changes we see in dementia. Or they say, my mother couldn't remember who was my sister, who I was, who are our children. Important changes in memory and changes in behavior. You know, the person is much more agitated or anxious or apathetic. So what you should be looking for is change from how they were before, because change is not always, but often a harbinger of brain disease.
Well, I think the things that you just mentioned are very different. Now, for instance, in terms of preparing a big meal, I know people, I mean, usually they let you know in advance. Like, that's one of the things they let go. They just say, you know what? I can't do this anymore. And it certainly doesn't show any cognitive decline. In fact, sometimes the opposite, where they're aware of what their limitations are. And it's certainly not the same as not recognizing people.
Yeah, but people can let go for different reasons. You're quite right. People, first of all, there can be physical problems. A parent has arthritis or trouble walking or balance. That's a different kettle of fish. But when the parent or grandparent says, I just can't get it together to do this anymore, that's a red flag. And obviously, it could be any number of reasons, but that's one of the red flags we look for. It's a change in function. Just like if the parent says, I just can't pay my bills now. I have trouble. I can't get on the internet. I can't handle the ATM. I can't organize my medications. But the problem is often that the person who's having cognitive problems, brain problems, may not be aware of it or may minimize it or deny it. It's often the family or the family members are much more aware than the person involved. So that leads into a very delicate situation of what should the family do? What should the kids do? What should they say? How they should handle it?
Now, one of the things I noticed when my mother-in-law, who had Alzheimer's, was alive, was isolation. So that if people had been isolated because of winter and had not interacted with others for a while, you know, when you saw them, their cognition would be lower, but sometimes it kind of came back after they spent a little time around people.
That's a very important observation. It's quite correct. Look, things that make people can have mild dementia, and it's made worse by a number of things. They're lonely, if they're isolated, if they're just not talking to people, if they're depressed, many people get depressed. If they're not sleeping, if they're not eating, if they're losing weight, all of those things are going to impact on brain function. So we like to test people at their best, realizing that there are times, everyone has their ups and downs, and we try to assess people when they're at their best and see if even at their best, they're worse than they were before. And this does bring into, there's a point I need to make that if you detect changes in your older family members, the important thing is not to try and push them, try harder to remember. That's not how it works. The thing to do is to gently and compassionately say, look, we're noticing some change. We think you should see your doctor and go with the family member. Make sure the person goes with the family member who says the family is noticing memory changes and we think they should be looked into. Because there are many times when we find things that are treatable, depression, lack of sleep, low thyroid, there are a number of conditions that can be treated. A doctor has to do the testing, do the blood test, and then come to a conclusion whether there's something more serious involved. So I think it's important not to just assume this is normal aging and this is normal senility, or assume there's nothing that can be done. Some people just have a nihilistic view that there's nothing we can do. That's just not true. As far as things to do to stimulate people, social stimulation by being with your family and friends, physical stimulation by exercising. Exercise takes 5 years off your brain age, and cognitive stimulation. We don't want older people or people at any age to be sitting on the couch just watching Judge Judy. You need to be doing something to challenge your brain and find something you're interested in that makes you think and builds your brain connections and keeps your brain as healthy as possible.
Okay, now you were talking about what to do and to encourage and perhaps even take the person to a doctor to be assessed. But I'm thinking your example of family coming in from out of town, seeing the older generation, I mean, you know, even if they have a family doctor, getting in over the holidays for something that's not urgent, I think is not something that's not going to be very easy for most people.
That's right. It won't happen as an emergency. And look, there's no way around it. If people, older people whose family has moved somewhere else and who are alone, are in a difficult situation. This is where you need your family members to come around or come back and help make sure you get to a physician. It won't be over the holidays, and it'll be, you know, weeks, will it be months to get in. As you say, many people don't have a family physician. So this is where you need family members to advocate for the older person, to help them make the appointments and to go with them. And this is important enough to make a trip back to see the parent or grandparent to make sure this gets looked into. It's not something you take them to emergency, but it's something that needs to be arranged, not years from now, but weeks from now.
Well, and even that can be a tall order. So again, what are the key things to look for?
So the key things are change from the previous level of memory function, and not change in a minor way. Okay, you can't remember when, you know, your grandchildren's birthday was, or you can't remember some minor headline, but an important change that the parent is forgetting the holidays, forgetting the family members, mixing them up. So, and when you have a conversation, even hours later, the person doesn't remember the conversation. Those are important red flags. And as I mentioned, the other red flag is inability to organize their day, to look after themselves, their medications, pay their bills. A lot of people, older people, are failing to pay their bills correctly and getting involved in scams. These are also red flags that their thinking isn't as clear as it used to be. And change in behavior and psychology. Some are becoming more agitated, more anxious, losing their temper, where in fact previously they were very even-tempered and never did this. So change in behavior, a change emotionally, these are more red flags that suggest maybe it's something in the brain.
Okay, and as you said, it might be something that is treatable.
Yes, and you know, even Alzheimer's disease, if I would have been here talking to you 10, 15 years ago, I would have said, look, all we have are treatments for the symptoms of Alzheimer's that improve people a little bit for a few months. But now we're in the age where we're starting to get the disease-modifying therapies, drugs coming down, which can, in some people, slow the progression or even stabilize the illness. Not in everyone, and they're not a home run, but the first anti-amyloid drug has been approved by Health Canada. So I think it's a time when really, people who are having early dementia, their families must make sure they get to a doctor. And people, we're learning more and more about prevention. Even people with mild memory loss benefit from prevention lifestyle strategies. At Baycrest, we've opened the Kimmel Center for Brain Health, which is a dementia prevention center where we encourage better diet, exercise, better sleep, and the cognitive stimulation that we think, even in people with mild memory loss, will slow the progression. So there's a lot that people can do. If you go on the Baycrest website, we've made 15 little videos of lifestyle things, interventions that everybody can do to maintain their brain health. So that's a good place to start looking.
Okay, well, sounds like very good advice and something to keep in mind as we celebrate with all generations of the family. Dr. Howard Chertkow, thanks so much.
Delighted to be here. Have a good holiday.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty, we are taking another break, and Dr. Chertkow just mentioned taking a loved one to a family doctor. There's a new study on the state of our shortage of family doctors. There's good news and bad news, and we'll have it when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we talk often about the shortage of family doctors, and there's both good news and bad news in the latest study. Well, here's the good news first. It's getting better. More Canadians have a family doctor or nurse practitioner now than 3 years ago. The bad news? Well, nearly 6 million people around the country still do not have a primary care physician. Dr. Tara Kieran is a family doctor and researcher, and she led the study as part of a project called Our Care, and she joins me now. Dr. Kieran, thanks so much for being with us. Dr. Kieran, are you...
Thanks. Okay. I am here. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So welcome. And first of all, were you surprised at what you found?
You know, I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that things had improved to that degree. Our last survey was done in the fall of 2022, and that's when we estimated that about 6.5 million adults in Canada didn't have a family doctor or nurse practitioner. And our new survey, as you said, brings that estimate down to 5.9 million. But we have to remember that during that time, there was actually pretty substantial population growth within Canada. So it is a notable achievement that we have are going in the right direction, that we have reduced the number who don't have access to primary care. Now, of course, 5.9 million people who don't have a family doctor or nurse practitioner is still far too many, and there is more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the work, I mean, one of the things that I find very challenging, certainly here in Ontario, is that the government keeps doing things. But it's announced in dribs and drabs, and I just find it very hard to put it all together to see kind of where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is a really complex issue, people not having a family doctor. And so there are many tacks that governments need to take in order to address it. So maybe I'll just summarize some of what I know is happening here in Ontario and also in some other parts of the country. I mean, notably, I will say that in June of this past year, June 2025, the government actually passed a first of its kind legislation called the Primary Care Act. It basically lays primary care as the foundation of the healthcare system and then lays out six objectives for that system. And those six objectives, I should say, actually mirror concept for concept what we heard from people across the country they wanted to see in a better system. So we did a whole bunch of consultations in 2022, 23, and we actually put something together called the Our Care Standard that describes what every person in Canada should be able to expect from the primary care system. Things like everybody having a family doctor, having timely and ongoing care, care that's wellness-oriented, that's culturally safe, that's empowering to patients, where people have their own records. And that's all actually enshrined in legislation now. And it includes the government reporting on its progress there. And so that's just one step that the Ontario government took. But I think it's actually a really important one because it clearly articulates the goal. Of course, this was after, in the fall of last year, about a year ago, they appointed Dr. Jane Philpott to lead a primary care action team. And they've committed by 2029 to have everybody attached to primary care and have committed more than $2.1 billion in that effort. So some real investments specifically in team-based care. Of course, there's also been things like opening up of new medical school spots, more family medicine residency training spots, as well as fast-tracking international medical graduates to practice in Ontario. So lots of things going on.
Well, okay. So I have some questions about some of those notes. So for instance, in the health team that I'm part of, by the way, people, we have a medical panel every Wednesday. So we'll be talking more about this with our medical panel. But so one of the doctors is on a health team and they got funding to expand the health team. So on their end, they had to make a commitment for 800 patients, and they've been trying to hire a nurse practitioner for months. And because of the shortages, they're having trouble.
Yeah, I mean, you're putting out a really good point. So first of all, great to hear that you're part of a health team. So in fact, actually only 25% of people in Ontario have that privilege. And I think part of the new reforms are to try and improve that and have everybody have access to that. Also great that we can see it in action, what's happening, new money being released and people raising their hand and saying, yes, I can take on more patients if I have more resources. But of course, the challenges is the health human resource shortages make that tricky. And so, you know, I hear that your own doctor is having a hard time hiring a nurse practitioner. You know, I think that perhaps we as a whole obviously have to hire more, but we also probably have to think about, are there other ways in which we can expand the number of patients doctors can see? Maybe it's more nurses or upskilling our clinical office assistants or having more social workers or pharmacists. So we have to use the resources we have while also training more people to be part of our healthcare system in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing you mentioned, Jane Philpott, and the commitment. Now, this was something that was flagged by the Auditor General just last week. And basically what she said is that people have to sign up through this Healthcare Connect, but people are not aware of Healthcare Connect. So any statistic based on placing people through Healthcare Connect is somewhat misleading.
You know, it's true that Healthcare Connect has had its challenges for many years, and I think the government now has recognized that. That's why they made a commitment that as of, you know, looking at the list as of January 2025, they would clear everyone who had been on that list, whether that person had been on the list for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. Like, some of these people have been on it for a long time. And so there's a real commitment to clearing out that list by the spring of 2026. So let's watch to see what happens. And there also is a commitment to make that list more functional. Absolutely. If we really want people to use Healthcare Connect, we have to make sure that it's actually working and attaching people, which I think it's starting to do more and more. But we also have to ensure that we are advertising it very widely, including in multiple languages, because, you know, we know that there are many newcomers to Ontario who struggle with access. And so we can't just be relying on English-French website communication to get the word out.
Well, yeah, indeed. The irony is that the government, I mean, this is well beyond the scope of your study, the government spent millions of dollars, like for a Ronald Reagan ad with the U.S. media outlets, but has not spent a lot of money advertising something like Healthcare Connect that people actually here at home really need. But again, all of these, do you see these problems as kind of just kind of glitches to be worked through? Or would you say everything is kind of on the right track?
I do think we're in a very hopeful time, and I am very optimistic that we're going to see improvements. I mean, these improvements won't just come to be because we want them to. They take real hard work and persistent dedication from so many people behind the scenes. You know, I've heard Jane Philpott speak publicly, and I know how committed she is, for example, to improving Healthcare Connect and clearing off that backlog. And I know she and the team are working really hard to do so. So that's just like an example of the really good people working hard behind the scenes to try and make things better. And they now, you know, we have more people dedicated to do that. We have more money to try and address the issue, at least here in Ontario. And so I actually do think Ontario is leading the way nationally when it comes to solutions. Of course, that's still very frustrating for the many people who don't have a family doctor or nurse practitioner right now. And we need to, you know, we need to do better when it comes to that. And I, in fairness to Dr. Jane Philpott, I've also heard her talk about how that's like really an urgent issue. And so that's why they're really trying to do things as quickly as possible, because they recognize how hard the current situation is for people.
I mean, again, one of the things is that even when people get attached, they end up being too far, or it's still hard to get in to see the doctor.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it's important to note that our survey actually is very comprehensive. You know, we just talked about one of the many statistics and data points that we have in our survey. Our survey actually really tries to understand people's experiences of primary care in relation to the Our Care standard. So these are the six elements that people across Canada said were important to them when it comes to the primary care system. So yeah, we have some important data around timely access. We see that people, even who do have a family doctor or nurse practitioner, you know, it's a very few of them are able to get an appointment the same or next day when they have an urgent issue. Only a third said that they could get care outside Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. You know, it's less than 50% who said that they could get an appointment when their clinician was away. So those are pretty serious issues related to access that we need to address. But then there are also important other aspects that our, you know, survey points to. For example, you know, we want to make sure people know what to do. And, you know, only 22% of people said that they knew what to do if there was an issue related to the quality of care in that they were receiving in primary care. We also have some important data around access to health records. You know, we see that, you know, 25% of people didn't even know what health records were available to them online. And those who did know, you know, yes, they had access to things like lab reports, but very few had access to anything else.
Interesting. Well, it sounds very comprehensive, and it's always good to hear some good news, even though it's possibly slow. Thank you so much, Dr. Tara Kieran.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Okay, that is all the time we have for today. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Be back tomorrow with our medical record panel to talk about these issues that really affect all of us, and I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.